Announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Our challenge this year is to encourage more listeners to become WILL supporters. So, we're asking you to help us build a member match fund to kick off the fall pledge campaign with a power hour Thursday, October 16th. By giving early, you'll encourage others to follow your lead and keep the pledge drive efficient. Send a check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. Thanks.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL, also on FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Kieser in for Celeste Quinn this Monday afternoon, and you're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. Our technical director, Jason Croft, our producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. And this afternoon, we have a regular monthly feature on the Afternoon Magazine, Computers and You. Joining me this afternoon is Peter Kimball. He's the computer-assisted instructor specialist with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. That's a mouthful. Good afternoon, Peter. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
It's nice to be back. It's nice to have a new host every once in a while.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I see you about once a month, when I'm on the morning shift. You come in and I see you outside my window from the weather office, so it's nice to actually be here in the studio with you to talk about computers. And those of you that are listening, if you want to call in with your computer-related question, you're free to do so. That's what this show's all about. And the numbers to call are 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-9455. WILL. And we already, Peter, have a caller on line one from Champaign. Why don't we get started? Good afternoon.
Good. Hello. My question is about basic website development. I got a domain name, and I have a hard copy portfolio of my work organized into different categories, photos. And I just want to do the simplest thing. I'd like to have just a home page with my contact info and some stunning picture and four category pictures. And then if they click on one of those pictures, I want them to be able to go to that category and pick some more pictures and pick one of those and go to that details of that thing. Is there a way available for a non-intimidated, only moderately skilled computer person to do this short of buying and going through the learning curve of Dreamweaver?
Yes, there almost certainly is. One of the first options would be if you are getting your internet access either via a cable modem, such as locally with Comcast, or through a DSL line through AT&T, part of that subscription includes a limited but probably quite adequate amount of web space. And they can also, or they also make available software that will allow you to easily upload your pages, images, with knowing very little about the underlying web development process. Essentially, you fill in blanks, you have a series of web pages that guide you through creating your own web pages. And that's
will you have any control other than some boilerplate template as to how each page, or at the least, how the home page looks?
You do have some. I understand. You do have some control, but not a great deal if you use their essentially push-button interface for bringing things, for specifying your home page and the images. Both of the, those internet service providers, the cable modem folks and the DSL line folks, will make it possible for you to upload your own pages, which can look any way you may wish. So that kind of pushes the problem a little bit further out so that you now need to be able to develop your own pages. There are a number of free or relatively inexpensive programs for designing web pages. They don't necessarily require a lot of expertise. In fact, even Dreamweaver, if you have access to it, at its most basic level of creating pages and links, has a very short learning curve. Most people could be doing things with it in less than an hour.
Really?
Now, you're not going to get real fancy with that, but you'll be able to have the page laid out pretty much the way you want, with images and links and multiple pages that are connected to one another. There are also, and I don't have real handy right in front of me, some programs for developing web pages that you don't even have to pay for. They're free downloads. You would find those with a Google search, for example, that will not be as fully functional as Dreamweaver, but will also be quite a bit simpler to use and won't have all of the extra options that you do have with Dreamweaver.
Really, all I'm trying to create has no... You know, none of the commercial functionality of sites you buy from. I just want someone to have an electronic equivalent of thumbing through my tab-indexed hard copy portfolio. So you think one of these other shorter learning curve deals would be fine for that?
Sure, I think so. And you could even get things up quickly by using the built-in templates with from your internet service provider. That would allow you to get the material up there quickly, and then you would at least have a presence. And you could then deal with having more of control over your layout later. The only issue that you're going to have, and there are, I believe, ways of dealing with this, but I'm not quite sure what the best will be, or will be the use of your own domain name as opposed to a name that's going to have the Comcast or AT&T.
Well, that would be a pretty critical initial jolt in the road there.
Sure.
Can you suggest how that would be accomplished? Is there a way to just, you know, like you use call forwarding on your telephone, is there a way to call forward, so to speak, from whatever AT&T was willing to give me to my, from my domain name that I bought to the AT&T one?
Yes. However, there may be a problem. Whomever the person or the organization is from whom you got your domain name, mycompany.com or whatever it might be, will, for the initial fee, reserve the domain name. Do you know if they also supply you with a small amount of web space for the fee you paid, or did they just register and reserve the name for you?
I think I bought... So far, a web hosting package of the most minimal type, and I do actually have a presence, which was an abortive effort by someone who offered but then ran out of time to really help me.
Well, that's going to be the way to go then, actually, as opposed to, because now that I'm realizing that you do have your own domain name, the web hosting provider, the registrar from whom you got your domain name, has much the same kind of facility as cable modem and DSL line providers do. They give you a certain amount of space for your basic fee. They probably give you a web builder set of software or web pages that you can use to create your site, and will also allow you to upload the pages using any of these very basic, even in some cases, free software packages. So we're just having it located at a different location. You can pretty much disregard or not really consider having it hosted by AT&T or by Comcast, since you do have your own name and you do have the host provider there that will at least be able to support some number of pages for you.
Okay, so basically then I was just kind of ill-informed that the fact that I got the domain name and the hosting package probably already includes some rudimentary tools which would accomplish more or less the basics of what I want.
It probably does. At the very lowest dollar cost, a number of registrars will give you only the reserved domain name, and there's not much you can do with it. For a few dollars more, typically $3 or $4 a month at the lowest, you actually have a website with basic tools to create your pages as well.
I paid that additional fee, so I imagine I do have that and just aren't taking advantage of all the stuff.
I think you probably do, then.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Quite welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we now move along. We have a few more callers online. If you want to join in on the conversation, the numbers to call are... You have a choice in town. It's 333-9455. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. And we move along now to line two from Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Oh, thank you. I use an iMac. It's 10.4 something. Anyhow, for quite a while I was able to receive email with podcasts on it, particularly one from a niece of mine. And then it suddenly, I can't use them. She apparently changed her the technical part of it. I have one in front of me now. And at the top, before what she's written, it says QuickTime VPIP, and VPIP is... caps, all cap letters. Okay, then she writes what she has to write. And then at the bottom it says download now. Okay, so I click the download, and I could read you all the thing it says. It says if you want me to.
Not yet, in a way. Anyway.
Okay, so I click on the download, and I get a window that's full of random letters. So it's just not working. Okay, now I just turn that off and go back.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing when you're clicking on that is it's just displaying that as a file. What you need to do is to download that as a software program that can then be installed, because just a whole bunch of random letters sounds like you're just looking at it as if it were a word processing document. VPIP is actually videos playing in place. It's a newer technology, so that's what that stands for.
There is a picture there. Maybe I can play that. No, it does not work. Okay, because there's a photo on her email of a video screen, but when I click the play button on that, the same thing happens. It goes to a new window with all of those strange letters instead of playing.
Well, that's an indication that the software itself, the QuickTime VPIP or the software to do it, has not been properly installed, because what should happen if that software is installed properly is it should actually go ahead and play it rather than show you a window with all of the equivalent text.
So that's not properly installed on my computer.
Correct.
Not on something she mailed out.
No, almost certainly not. It is certainly possible that if she's mailing something out that's not properly formatted, can you
I would not think so, because it's she's getting on the way to being a pro.
Right. Well, what you might do to test that and to also see if there are any particular difficulties is there is actually a VPIP.org website that is designed to assist people and to promote this video picture in place technology.
Does the picture in place mean that if it's there on the email that you really should be able to click on
if
it?
If everything
opens right
is there and it is in a proper VPIP file, then essentially it should be able, when everything is properly set up, you should be able to click on it. And you're looking at your email within a browser, I presume? You're using Safari or something? Or
No, I'm not using the browser. I'm using the mail program on my iMac.
Okay.
The built-in mail program.
Right. That may also be part of the problem. What you can do, your email account? Is it a Gmail or it's through Comcast?
Should I try doing it on the browser?
Try it on the browser because it's quite possible that the VPIP software, the QuickTime presumably VPIP software, is active with the browser, but your email program is not aware of it and doesn't know what to do with it.
Oh.
So that would be the next thing that I would try doing.
Okay.
Is trying to read the email and then click on the link in the browser. If the browser asks you to download a file or it needs to update a file, go ahead and do that. And then if that doesn't work, I would probably Google my way over to using terms such as VPIP, Mac, iMac, QuickTime, and you'll find a number of sites, including some where they have examples, troubleshooting, and other sorts of assistance for people who are having difficulty with it.
Okay,
but I would first try it in the browser as opposed to in the email program.
Okay. Tell me something. Is QuickTime an iMac program?
QuickTime is it certainly runs on the iMac. It is Apple designed software for showing video, but there's QuickTime available for Windows. There's QuickTime available for the Mac.
Okay, so I should have this, and I'm sure I have that on my computer then.
Yes, it may be that you need to update QuickTime to the most recent version that supports VPIP.
Oh, okay. Well, usually I get emails from Apple to update things, so I would guess I have the refund.
Probably. You can also bring up QuickTime. You should be able to find, if you're logged on with administrative rights, as you may well be on the iMac, you should be able to check for system updates from the it's up there in the Apple menu, I think, someplace for updates. And
I've seen that occasionally. I haven't ever actually used it. Okay, update from Apple menu. Okay.
But you're right. Normally, it will try to advise you if you are needing any updates, unless you have inadvertently turned that feature off, which you can do.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I guess I've taken up my share of time.
Well, good luck. There's often a fair amount of details that you have to work with to get video and other kinds of technologies working, especially when they change it.
Well, thank you very much for your call. And that's the one thing I've noticed. It seems that there's so many different formats out there, people sending video in just an amazing number of formats anymore. And it's hard to, I think, keep up sometimes.
And what worked last week might not work next month.
And I've encountered that for sure. Well, I'm sure that a lot of you have similar type questions. And again, we're doing our Computers and You segment. My guest is Peter Kimball for this hour. And you can give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And we now move on to line three, and we have a caller from Champaign-Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. Can you discuss, how to get cash in and out of PayPal, like via debit card, and two, retrieving lost data, like some web email systems, if not used in a certain number of days, lose the inbox, but strangely they keep some other elements like the calendar, and some very cheap web pages, if not updated in a year, they just disappear without warning. Okay.
Well, as far as PayPal is concerned, I've occasionally used PayPal. I usually, when I'm making purchases online, tend to use what's called a virtual credit card through one of my credit cards that allows me to generate a single-use number. I would simply go to the PayPal site and discover by a little bit of exploration there how to either deposit into your PayPal account or to pull money that has been deposited there out. But I have no direct experience that's recent enough to be useful other than to just go to PayPal and check on it. The other question was with regard to often websites that you can use for email. So you have an email account, Comcast locally and AT&T, if you've got an account with them, do that. But there are many other companies as well, Yahoo and Microsoft and such. And I have noticed that Yahoo in particular, after about a year of inactivity, will assume that you're no longer there and will delete a number of things. I know one person had been away from their account for a long time decided they would go back to it, and they got a warning message that said, in essence, this has been treated as an abandoned account. We can still retrieve it if you want to move to the premier version. In other words, they wanted to get, you know, $2 or $3 or $5 a month out of you. Otherwise, click here to accept the fact that it's all gone. Once it has been deleted, short of a court order or steps that they're probably not willing to take, I think it's probably nearly impossible to get that back. Certainly, they have backups of all of that. They have to in case law enforcement needs to get some of that information. But it would be a major effort in many cases for them to retrieve email that has been purged from the system and is only in backup. You could certainly talk to their technical support people if it were really urgent and critical that you recover some of that, but they're probably going to resist doing that and may simply flat out tell you it's not possible. It really is, but in terms of normal consumers, it may not be. Web pages, I'm unaware of any that do that. Generally, if it's a free website where you can post your pages, they may well be limited in terms of the amount of space they have available. They can't leave it sitting there forever, especially since after some amount of time they don't know whether somebody has just left the country for a while and is coming back or whether they're gone forever. So, again, the technical support connection either via email, usually via email at a lot of the cheaper sites because they very seldom give you a phone number. You can inquire as to whether there's any way to retrieve those pages, but I guess my general advice would be to go to one of the sites that, as far as I know, does not have a timeout. Certainly Gmail and such is a very popular one, and they just keep giving you more space. I suppose it would be possible. I don't know what their policy is. If you spent if you were away for 5 years, you might come back and find that it's not there. But for the online services, there is often not a very good way of getting any of that information back once they've decided you're gone and have deleted it. Hate to be the bearer of bad tidings.
Doesn't sound good. Well, thank you very much for your call. And I guess I have a question along those lines. I've never really thought about this. We rely on Gmail or Yahoo Mail or Hotmail, and is there an easy way to make a copy of your messages so as to kind of have a backup in case?
Well, a lot of those services, including Gmail and I suspect Hotmail and the others as well, allow you to not only read the email via their website, but if you have a regular email client such as Outlook or Eudora, then you can configure those to grab a hold of that mail. It's an acronym, but it's called popping your mail. It's Post Office Protocol. I do that. A lot of people affiliated with the university may do that as well. They can read their email via a website, or they can use a program such as an email client like Outlook or Eudora. And that can easily be set up to retrieve all of the email that's there, stored on your own local machine, leaving it still on the server so that you can still get to it and read it via a web browser and delete it only when you wish. And I do that as a regular practice. I probably have more email than I really need archived, but almost anything that's ever been sent I could get to because it is not dependent upon being stored someplace else that I have no control of.
Okay, that's something I've thought of before and never really followed up on, and so it's good to know that that's possible.
The same thing is true with a lot of the online services now that allow you to do word processing and PowerPoint or presentation software, presentations and slideshows. They can certainly be stored online, but generally most people feel a little bit safer if they've got their own copy as well.
Well, I know that I'm probably like many, and I don't back things up as often as I should, and hope that day doesn't come soon where we have a problem. Anyway, we're going to move right along here. It seems like this is a Champaign and Urbana-dominated show, and now we're going to go to line one, and we have a caller from Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I guess that's me. I'm running Vistas with HomeMode Premium with Service Pack 1. And one of the things that I used all the time on XP was pressing the start button and then pressing the E for Explorer will launch Explorer. But it doesn't do that now under Vista.
The start button on the little Windows button on the keyboard?
Yeah.
Well, I'd certainly tell you about that if I had a Vista machine here.
Yeah, I do have an XP machine there.
It's our studio quality computer here. Windows 2000.
Yeah.
I do the same shortcut, the window key E for to launch Explorer.
Yeah.
We're currently, because we don't have in our labs quite the hardware capability we need, we're currently not running Vista regularly, just on a couple of machines.
Okay.
So I don't have a good answer. I would try to do a Google search and see a Vista window E Explorer shortcut, in Windows Explorer shortcut, and see if you can find something like that. Vista Windows key shortcuts. Well, there it is. Let's see what we've got here. And there's a whole bunch of pages that might give you some possibility of looking into it. Yeah.
Another little problem I had that I worked around very quickly was I was using Notepad for quick text stuff, and then all of a sudden it started to give me all kinds of error messages that it wouldn't save unless I pressed cancel. So I just got rid of it and downloaded TED.
That may be the best solution. I haven't seen that particular problem with Notepad. Was it telling you why it wanted you to...
Yeah, it gave me some kind of cryptic, computer geek message, I've got rid of it, so I can't tell you what.
It could be with Vista's increased security that the default place that Notepad was trying to save was a place that you didn't have regular access to.
Yeah, that's right. It was wanting to look for a path that didn't exist anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
And the first, if you'd gone in there and specified, you were able to launch Notepad, but you couldn't save it.
But I couldn't save a file,
A moot point now because you're using TED, but by going in and manually specifying another path, it would have then remembered that from then on.
Well, it kept giving that same error message about three or four times when I pressed cancel. Then pretty soon it would come up, and then I would do C:// file name, and bam, that would save it.
Yeah.
So TED solved it.
Good.
So, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Thank you very much for your call. And I guess one thing I wanted to ask you about here is Vista's been out for a while now, but I know in the early days of Vista, at least, a lot of people are still recommending, put XP on your computer. Vista's still got a lot of issues. I know it's harder now to find a computer with XP if you're buying a new one, but is Vista coming along enough now to be reliable? Or
yes, there are two concerns with Vista. When it first came out, a lot of the older software, and included in that software category, was a lot of the underlying software that talked to devices like scanners and printers and such, had not been updated to be able to interact with Vista well. The other problem was Vista definitely requires more power on part of the computer, and so most machines that had been, even today, if the computer is one that's more than 3 or 4 years old and has not been upgraded, it may not have the underlying power to work Vista well. But Vista on new machines that have adequate memory and adequate speed has proven to be very reliable, very few issues in terms of compatibility, because as it comes from the manufacturer as opposed to being updated from older versions, everything's going to work. You don't have the driver issues. Windows 8 is not too far around the corner, so we're going to be having – or Windows 7, it's Internet Explorer 8 that's available, but the next version of Windows is going to be out, and it is according to all reports, based on Vista, but we can be relatively sure that Microsoft has taken to heart a lot of the complaints about the rollout of Vista, so we'll see what happens there.
Well, maybe those of us still in the XP environment should wait until 7.
That's true. However, it is still, if you're waiting and you've got a machine that's now 4 or 5 years old, there is a very good possibility that it will not behave properly. Simply won't be able to have the background speed and memory that would make you happy with the experience with any newer operating system. But it's very slick if you've got the power. It's really very nice.
Okay, well, I'll have to check it out on somebody's faster machine than what we have here. we'll move right along. We're in the Computers in Use segment. We're a little bit past our halfway point. And again, if you'd like to get in a question, we still have several minutes to go. 333-9455 is our telephone number, 333-WILL, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And we now move along to line two in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. Just to sort of solve a mystery, about a month ago, I sent my email to a friend, and reverse send back email, all that kind of thing. I could never find it, and what I was doing was, it's on a Yahoo, my email is a Yahoo, so I was going back, and I was eliminating a lot of the, previous emails, I don't know how many, few hundred or so or more, and I get right toward the end, and there's an email that's listed for 1970. So that was the email. How did that happen?
I've seen that occasionally. It can be a problem with the email service. It can be a problem with the original machine which sent the email. The date is really... Generally, the date is information that is sent along with the emails, and that can be sent incorrectly. I've received some email kind of the opposite sort of problem. When first downloading a bunch of email into a new client, it says, oh, this just came down on September 22nd, and I'll have September 22nd, today's date, for a lot of email, even though some of it may be weeks or months older. It is generally not the fault of your email program. It is something earlier along the line, either on the sender's program or on the sender's email service provider that just stuck in the wrong date or had an illegally formatted date, in which case it defaults to be plain old 1970.
This is Leapfrog. You familiar with that one?
No, I'm not.
Okay. My daughter years ago used to use this, and... that's what it came through, and there was Leap Mail or something, a Mail Leap or some other. But it was a strange feeling. It was like Back to the Future or something.
Yeah, very strange. One of the things that I will often do, and you can generally do this with email that you're storing on a program such as Outlook or Eudora, is not even sort the incoming email, just allow it to stack up in the order in which it was received. Because if it's sorted by date, of course, anything from 1970 is going to go way at the beginning.
Wow, okay. So
that way I'll just see the most recent ones, no matter what their date happens to be. And I do notice sometimes the dates jump around a little bit.
Yeah, now the other one you mentioned, the virtual, in terms of checking, how does that work? You're talking about with a credit card.
Some credit card companies. Citibank does this. Discover does it. There may be a few others as well. Have available for you, either as a little download or as a website, a facility in which you can identify yourself. You log on with a name and a password, and then it allows you to create a special one-time usable only credit card number. Mm. You can even specify a maximum amount. So if I'm going to make an online purchase and it's going to be for $50, I can create a credit card number through either Discover or through Citibank or whomever that will be good only for one merchant, only for one time, and for no more than that amount of money.
How effective is the other one that keeps changing? They can't change the card number or something or other?
Essentially it generates a brand new card number for you that is then tied to your card. So when you get your statement, you'll see here are your charges, and this charge, by the way, is on your account, but it was used created using virtual a card number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much.
It a very safe way of shopping online, I've found.
Well, that's good, too, because I know there's people out there that are trying to get your information all the time. We'll move right along now to another caller on line three, and I believe this caller is from Urbana. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello. In regard to the earlier discussion about using a mail client to
yes.
download mail, I had an experience with AT&T. It was working fine with Eudora, and then I switched to Thunderbird, and it worked fine for a month or so. And then I started getting messages, unknown sender or something of that sort, register with AT&T. And there was a site you were supposed to go to, which proved not very informative, and which I could never manage to register my email address. And I finally called them. I used the chat system and spent about 3 hours with them and never got anywhere. Finally, the other day, I became really disgusted and called their help number, and they essentially told me, use their mail system. And then they finally said, okay, for $300, we'll sell you support. We can fix it for that. And I got a little mad and threatened to call the state's attorney general, and they let me talk to somebody else. And it turns out what you have to do is go into their mail program, and there's an options, and then you choose mail, and choose options again, and you go through about five or six systems until you get down to a point where you can actually register the mail server, in my case, of the University of Illinois. And the actual operation is cumbersome enough, but it takes less than 5 or 6 minutes. And once that's accomplished, it works fine. But it's a major headache trying to find out from AT&T how to do it.
Well, I'm glad you're able to solve that. And certainly in an attempt to minimize spam and other sorts of unwanted mail, a number of email providers, AT&T and others, are trying to implement these sorts of controls so that people can't just sit out there and spam away to their heart's content. But I agree with you, it's very cumbersome, and some companies do not have very supportive policies. I'm glad that you were able to bypass the $300 fee, which you probably wouldn't have paid anyway. But it is, the intention underneath is good, but the implementation in many cases leaves a lot to be desired.
Well, I hope the intention is good. I have my doubts. However, I hope that anyone that has this problem will be able to, from this explanation, you have to go into their mail program, and choosing options, just work your way down through about six steps.
Yeah, $300 worth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on finding that, and hopefully anybody else will be able to do the similar thing and possibly find related problems from people who have posted things that you could do a Google search and find as well.
Yeah. Thunderbird does work just wonderfully for downloading university mail once you get it working.
Yeah. Great.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we're winding down to our last 10 minutes on the program. If you have a call about computers, now's the time to call. You can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Peter Kimball is here to take your questions, and we're now moving along to line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have two quick unrelated questions. First, I have an older computer. I'm going to get a newer one maybe later this year, but I run XP on it, and I use Firefox. Do I need to continue? Can I just skip all the Internet Explorer updates? Because I don't ever use it, but I know it's sort of tied into the rest of the system, so I'm uncertain if I can skip that. And then my other question was, I'm trying to fix my mother's laptop. It's an old laptop as well. And I actually think that it's unfixable after doing some Google searches, like you said, and finding out that this particular computer has motherboard problems. It's actually the laptop that caught fire, if you remember those, like a couple years ago. And so one of the suggestions they gave was taking it apart and cleaning it out, and I've never done that before, but since the computer doesn't work anyway, I was wondering if you even thought it would be worth it to take it apart. What it is apparently this one has a bad motherboard, but sometimes some people clean it out and it works again. So I don't even know if it's worth that, and I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, first question, no, it's not actually necessary for you to do the updates for Internet Explorer, but you should also keep in mind that there are some websites that will not function properly without Internet Explorer. And so if any of your banks or accounting or other sites that you need to get to on occasion actually work under Internet Explorer but not well otherwise, it would be worth updating Internet Explorer, mostly because of the additional security.
Okay.
If you never use it, you don't have to update it. But if you need to use it on occasion for specific sites, it probably is worth updating. And again, it's not so much for the extra functionality, but for the added security and the patches and the fixes and such.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the old laptop, if it doesn't work now and you're vaguely interested in it, sure, go for it. It might not work when you get it put back together, but that's no different than the situation now.
Exactly.
And it might be kind of interesting to see what's in there. And I would give your chances of it working when you take it apart and put it back together probably less than 50-50, but more than zero. And sometimes go ahead.
It kind of said, like, and the other thing they said, apparently this particular, I looked this up on Google last night, this particular one attached the motherboard to something called a heat sink, and so even repairing the motherboard for, like, regular, you know, I mean, is nearly impossible, so it's not. And since it's so old, I probably won't do anything beyond trying to clean it out, but if some people said when they got in there and they cleaned out all the lint and dust and whatnot, that it worked. So I'm like, well, you know.
It's possible, but again, you just never know. Sometimes the magic take it apart and put it back together technique works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Kind of like hitting, you know, your old washer and dryer.
Uh-huh, that's it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, and we're now going to move along to line two in Urbana. Line two, good afternoon, and welcome to Computers and You on the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello, is that me?
You are on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I have two computers that I have Eudora on, both of these computers. I'd like to move the mailbox addresses from one to the other. What procedure would I have to do for that?
There are files, so this is your actual address, the mailboxes themselves you want to move, or your address book?
I just want to have the address book moved.
Okay, there are files there. I'm just looking to see if I can find this. I have done that myself because I am still using Eudora. And there is a... how to move and backup files. What I did is I just did a Google search. I'm at eudora.com, and if you do a Google search, it will list all of the files that you need to move. For example, if you want to move the address book, any file with the name, it says here, NNDBase, regardless of file extension, is your main Eudora nickname address book. If there's anything in the nickname folder, I'm just getting that off of the very first link that I found when I did a Google search for Move Eudora Files. And there's the first link that I got was how to move and backup files in Windows, and it's actually a link to the Eudora.com website. It lists exactly what you need to move.
Okay, what is that again? I'm sorry.
Well, what I would do is just do a Google search for the phrase Move Eudora Files.
Mm-hmm.
And then just hit the first link that you've got on that goes to eudora.com, and it will give you, you know, it's a big, long address, but the easiest way of getting to it is via Google. And it'll say which files you need to copy in order to get your mailboxes or your address book or your any of the other features that you've got there in Eudora.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for your call, and we're winding down to the last few minutes. We do have another caller on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon. Welcome to Computers and You on the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. Are you hearing me?
Yes, we are.
Okay. With regard to the question of the 1970 date on email.
Yes.
I have an AT&T 3B1 computer. It has a Unix operating system. And when its battery is dead, one of these little coin-sized batteries to maintain the memory when the power's off, if that fails, then all files are dated 1970.
Sure, because that's what the clock resets to, is at zero point when it's, in essence, unplugged because the battery has
right.
gone dead.
Right, so that may be the explanation.
Yeah, that is quite possibly the problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. We've got only 3 minutes left on the show. So if you have a quick question, you still can call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And while we wait for another call, one thing I know we were talking about before the show is you mentioned something about web domain names. There's going to be a lot more of them, you'd say? Or?
Yes. The organization that controls the so-called top-level domains, the things like the .com, .net, .org, etc. There have been a few additional of those domains added recently, but they have now opened it up so that almost any combination of characters can be used. A registrar will have to pay a fee to do that, but they'd be able to offer things such as tornadoes, .tornadoes, or .anything you might wish. There are almost no limits, although there will be some vetting of things to allow to prevent really inappropriate names, but they're going to be completely wide open within the next couple, 3 years.
Interesting. Dot tornadoes. I'll have to think about that.
Might, yeah.
Well, we do have one more caller, probably the last call of the day on the Afternoon Magazine, and this is on line one, a caller from Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. I listened to that lady that was before the last guy that was cleaning the dust out of her computer. I wonder if somebody told her she should clean up her computer. And she thinks about dust, but yet they mean clean and defragment.
Well, possible, except she was also cleaning and defragmenting or making a hard drive so that it doesn't have lots of little segments is certainly good routine maintenance to do via software. But I think in her case, she literally was talking about dust because of the discussion about the heat sink and all of the other dust and such that can accumulate and block transfer of heat actually on the inside. But yes, there are many meanings of cleaning up your hard drive and cleaning up your computer system, and that's certainly one of them.
I just caught the end of that. But
yeah.
Since that's what she meant, I just happened to have a computer on my kitchen table for the very first time with the side panel off because my both my DVD and my CD burners quit working at the same time. So I said to myself, something's unplugged. And I've got it all apart now. Is there anything in there that I might touch that might really hurt me that when it's all unplugged?
No, when it's all unplugged and you've allowed the, leave it unplugged for at least 30 seconds or so internal capacitors can discharge. There's no high voltage in there. There's nothing that will hurt you. If you bend or break anything, obviously you could hurt the computer. But what you can do is look for the cables that come out of the, connected somehow to the back of the or the sides of the CD and DVD burners, and kind of push on them, wiggle them a little bit to make sure they're connected properly, both in the CD side of things and wherever they plug into the main circuit board.
I kind of did find a cable that was almost like a big ribbon about 2 inches wide, and it was just hanging there unplugged, and I plugged it in there, but I haven't gotten it back together yet.
Well, sometimes those cables have, if it looked like it was unplugged and it should have been plugged in, that could well have fixed it. Sometimes those cables have additional plugs in case additional equipment is added, so not every connector that doesn't seem to have a mate is a problem, but it could well be if it had come loose, that might be your problem.
Well, thank you very much. We've run out of time. Believe it or not, it went very quickly.
Are you going
to be back next month?
Yes, we'll be back on the third Monday of, it's got to be October.
October already. Well, thank you very much, Peter. Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois, and we'd like to thank our technical director, Jason Croft, and producer, Harriet Williamson, and thank all of you for calling in and for all of you that didn't call in that were listening this hour. It's now 1:54 in the afternoon. That means it's time for some settlement prices. And with that, we go to Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Ed. We'll take a look not at the settlement prices, but the outside markets first, because that's where all the action is and what's been pushing the prices in Chicago. Sharply higher on this afternoon. Crude oil futures are up $24.45 in the nearby October at this hour. $129 a barrel to trade. November contract is gaining as well at $6.30 higher at $109.05. Ethanol at $2.24 and 2 tenths is up 4 7/10 for the day. Gold at $43.30 higher is trading at $903.90, and the Dow is at 11,187. It, of course, is down just about 200 points. And the U.S. dollar taking a beating at this hour, down 155 at 76.18. But it's the crude oil, that sharp jump, up nearly $26 now in the crude oil a barrel for the nearby October. And the November, the underlying contract up $6.30, which has really put the marketplace in Chicago into the upside gear. Nearby contract for December wheat today, a 757 and three quarters top, bottom at 715. A settlement price is $7.37 and three quarters, up 19 and three quarters. March 775, the high, the low at 35. Settlement price at 757 and three quarters, up 20 cents in the May. 787 and three quarters, the high, the low at 750 and a quarter. Settlement price at $7.70 and three quarters of a cent, up 20 and a half. July futures, $8, the high for the July next year's wheat, 759 and a quarter, the low. Settlement price, 20 and a quarter cents higher at $7.82 and one quarter. December hard red winter wheat up 13 and a half cents, 798 and a half. The settlement price, that's actually for the spring wheat in Minneapolis. And the December wheat in Kansas City up 17 and a half cents today for the hard red at $7.74. December contract in the corn pit, 19 and three quarters of a cent, rather 16 and a quarter of a cent the gain. 564 and a half, the high, the low at 535 and a quarter. Settlement price at 558 and a half. Up 16 and a quarter on the afternoon. March futures 581, the high, the low at 552 and three quarters. Settlement price at 576 and a quarter, up 17 and a quarter. The May contract 591 and a half, the high, the low at 66 and a half. Settlement price at 587 and a quarter, up 17 and three quarters. July corn futures $6, the high, the low at $5.72. And a settlement price at 596 and a half, up 18 and a quarter for the afternoon. December oats 341, up 9 and a quarter. November beans finished 61 and a half cents higher today. 12.12 and a quarter, the high, the low at 11.34. Settlement price at $12 and a nickel. November beans 61 and a half cents, the gain. January futures 12.29 and a quarter, the high, the low at $11.51. Settlement price at $12.22. A bushel up 62 and three quarters in the March contract, 12.42 and three quarters, the high, the low at $11.66. March soybean settled at 12.36 and a half, up 63 and one half cents. May futures 12.52, the high, the low at 11.89. Settlement price at $12.47, up 65 on the afternoon. October bean meal at $3.23.30, up $10.80. October bean oil at $49.55, finished $2.63 higher on the afternoon. More from the Mercantile Exchange in just a moment.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Group's livestock side now, nearby October contract, 102.70, the high, the low at 102, 2.5, and a settlement price at 102.45. The October live cattle, 90 cents higher. December futures, 104.35 high, low at 103.60, settlement price at $103.90, up 65 cents in the Febs, 97.5 cents the gain, 104.90 the high, the low at 103.60, settlement price for February live cattle at 104.15, 97.5 cents higher. September feeder cattle, $108.45 the high, the low at 108 and a nickel, settlement price at $108.15, down a dime. October futures were higher, 107.45 the high, the low at 106, and a settlement price at 107.05, up $1.20. November feeder cattle, 107 the high, the low at $105.65 per 100 pounds. Settlement price for the November feeder cattle at $106.47.5 on the contract, $1.17.5 higher. October lean hog, $69.60 the high, the low at $68.20. A settlement price there at $68.65, 45 cents higher. December lean hog future, $67.70 the high. The low at $66.65, settlement price at $67.35, $1.30 the gain. February lean hog futures for the day settled $72.72.5 on the high. The low at $71.75, and a final price at $72.60. The February lean hog futures gained $1.47.5 on the afternoon, and the February belly settled at $93.72.5, up $2.82.5. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 in Urbana. We're now in fall, and it's 2 o'clock Central Time. In just about 6 minutes, we'll talk during the closing market report.